Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1197, I will have four segments. First, we will listen to Palestinian pastor Munzir Ishaq's sermon to the West, delivered from Bethlehem in occupied Palestine, the birthplace of Jesus. During the second segment, we will air the remarks of Natalie Stricker, human and social rights activist and campaigner based in the UK, who served as a human rights monitor in Hebron in 2018. She spoke at a vigil held for Palestine about Christmas and what it means. During the third segment, we will listen to an opinion by Sumaya Al-Ghannouchi, a British-Tunisian writer and expert in Middle East politics, on Zionist evangelicals attempting to erase centuries of Palestinian Christianity. And during the fourth segment, and in memory of Mohammed Bakri, award-winning Palestinian actor and filmmaker who died at the age of 72 on December 24, 2025 in Palestine, I will air an interview I conducted with him 12 years ago on this program, Arab Voices. Amongst his production is the award-winning Palestinian film documentary Jenin Jenin, about Israel's 2002 assault on the West Bank town of Jenin. As most of the world celebrated Christmas this year, 2025, Palestinian Christians who have been living under a brutal Israeli military occupation for a very long time that has been targeting them, demolishing their homes, attacking their properties, shooting and murdering them, and that is the case for all Christian Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the occupied Gaza Strip. When it comes to occupied Palestine, every Palestinian is a target of apartheid Israel, whether they are Muslims or Christians. Palestinian pastor and author Munzir Ishaq, whom I interviewed on this program before, delivered a sermon, a message, to the world in October 2025, and especially to the West, from Bethlehem in occupied Palestine, the birthplace of Jesus. The message was made possible by Bethlehem Institute for Peace and Justice. Let's listen in.
My name is Munzir Ishaq. I am a Palestinian pastor from Bethlehem, a follower of Jesus Christ. Many people are surprised to know that Palestinian Christians still exist. But it should be surprising if we didn't, because this is where it all began. Bethlehem is the birthplace of Jesus. Jerusalem is the city of the resurrection and the first church. I was born in Bethlehem and I grew up in a town called Beit Sahur, also known as the Shepherd's Field, the site where the shepherds heard the angels singing, "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace among those with whom he is pleased." And as Palestinian Christians, we have been preserving the witness of the gospel, sharing the good news of God's love from the very place where it all started, and continuing the legacy of our ancestors, the shepherds. I want to send this message to our brothers and sisters in Christ around the world. We are one body. We are one church. Yet, today in Palestine, we as Palestinian Christians feel forgotten. We feel our voices are silenced and ignored. Since October 7, 2023, the world's attention has been on our land. When Hamas attacked military bases and also Israeli towns and villages, and on that day, innocent lives were lost. There was worldwide outrage, anger, and condemnation, and rightly so, especially for the killing and kidnapping of children. But as Palestinians, we wonder, why is it that when Palestinian children are killed or kidnapped, there is little to no condemnation, no widespread outrage? Tens of thousands of Palestinians have been killed, including 20,000 children, 20,000. Many starved to death. Yet the global church remains largely silent or even dismissive of our suffering, sometimes justifying it or calling for violence in response. And when we cry out against these atrocities, we often hear justifications. We're told not to blame Israel for dropping bombs, but to blame Hamas for using human shields, usually without any proof. But think about this. If a serial killer hides in a building and takes children hostages in a city like New York or Chicago, would you destroy the neighborhood? Would you flatten it to eliminate the threat? Gaza is devastated, completely ruined. Does this resemble a war of self-defense? Does it look like precise strikes or the annihilation of an entire people? Israel has dropped more tons of explosive on Gaza than Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. Would you accept this in your own city? If a terror cell were discovered beneath Notre Dame in Paris. Would you let Israel bomb it? Would you stay silent? Yet one of the oldest churches in the world was targeted by Israel. 18 people were killed, including 9 precious children. And the world remains silent. Why? Did we allow theology to blind us to the humanity of our brothers and sisters in Christ? We are traumatized. Where is the mourning? Are we less human? As Palestinian Christians, we believe Israel's motives go beyond eradicating Hamas. It's about vengeance. It's about displacing Palestinians so that Palestinians can never have a state. Listen to the words of Israeli leaders before and during this conflict. The defense minister ordered a siege on Gaza, referring to its people as human animals, with over 1 million children involved. Human animals. Many reports suggest that Israel's actions may amount to genocide by experts, human rights organizations, and even Israeli Jewish scholars.
אנחנו כובשים, מטהרים, ונשארים עד להשמדת חמאס. בדרך, אנחנו משמידים את כל מה שעוד נשאר מהרצועה, פשוט, כי הכל שם זו עיר טרור אחת גדולה. במסגרת המלחמה הצהל מניע אוכלוסייה מאזורי הלחימה ולא משאיר אבן על אבן. אני אומר לכם, פשוט תסתכלו על הסרטונים של מה שקורה ברצועת עזה. האוכלוסייה תגיע לדרום הרצועה.
And it was amazing. And you can't help but think, like, it's nice to know that you're dancing in a concert whilst hundreds of thousands of Gazans are, you know,
homeless,
like sitting in a tent and eating.
Makes it even better.
Yeah.
More enjoyable concert. If only they put the
live video
footage of Gaza. Like, but seriously, you guys, like, that's what people don't understand. Look, like, I know that you guys might be appalled by this, some of the listeners, but seriously, this is how Israelis feel.
If you gave me a button to just erase Gaza, every single living being in Gaza would no longer be living tomorrow, I would press it in a second. And I think most Israelis would.
Yeah. Most Jewish Israelis.
They wouldn't post, they wouldn't talk about it like I am.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't post, they wouldn't say I pressed it.
Yeah.
But they would press it, right? Like if they were in a closet alone, they wouldn't even hesitate
to totally clean Gaza. Cleanse. You want to call it ethnic cleansing? I'm fine with it. We need to ethnically cleanse Gaza.
I got to be careful the way I say this. They're going to try to ethnically cleanse Gaza.
Yep.
I mean, I don't use that term lightly, okay?
Genocide is an issue that every human being should be concerned about and stand against. Israel can say whatever they want and use whatever excuse, whether it is Hamas, whether it is October 7th or whatever. And October 7th was real. We all, for all of us, it was probably the scariest days of most Israelis I know, including me. But that doesn't allow you to start a war against an entire people in order to destroy them and to eliminate them.
These organizations have examined and published hundreds of pages of evidence in why this fits the technical and historical definition of genocide. I challenge you, examine the evidence and judge for yourself.
This is not anti-Semitic. You know, doing what's right and speaking up for the press is not anti-Semitic in any way.
What does it say when one of the world's leading scholars of the Holocaust believes Israel's assault on Gaza is undoubtedly a genocide?
And you can see systematic destruction of universities, schools, mosques, museums, hospitals, and of course, housing and infrastructure, making it not only impossible for people to live in the Gaza Strip, making it basically uninhabitable, but also making it impossible for the population to revive its own cultural and educational life.
These are scholars, many of whom have been studying the Holocaust their entire adult life. They have studied the data of what is going on, and they are all calling it a genocide. Ask yourself, why would that be the case? So if you deny this, respond to the evidence. But if you refuse to see the truth, then the real question is, why is it being denied? As Palestinians, we are exhausted from seeing images of children and entire families pulled from under the rubble. We have agonized over footage of first responders searching desperately, hoping to find signs of life, and we have wept with parents calling out the names of their children, desperately hoping for their return.
Oh.
Am I my brother's keeper? What is the gospel message to these children? Does it really have nothing to say to them? And so we continue to ask, are we less human? What happened to the conscience of humanity? What happened to the church's call to be compassionate, to seek justice? And then some claim that Palestinians do not belong in the land because God does not want us here. And that the promise made to Israel in scripture overrides our presence. Is this the gospel? Really? And let me remind you that Israel was established on the ruins of Palestinian towns and villages. See, at the beginning of the 20th century back then, Palestine was nearly 95% Arab Palestinians and 5% Jews. Israel was not created on empty land. Palestinians were displaced and more than 800,000 became refugees. And Israeli settlers attack our villages constantly, including Christian villages.
My neighborhood, Sheikh Jarrah, which is located in Jerusalem, is facing the imminent threat of disposition by the Israeli settlers and Israeli police and army.
You are stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going to steal it.
No one is allowed to steal it, Yami.
Can you imagine living in your own property and having someone just come and snatch you out of it? It is somebody coming physically, violently stealing our property.
This Palestinian Christian woman is going head to head with Israeli soldiers after settlers kicked her family off their land in the occupied West Bank.
People, they are now sitting on our table in our land. They are eating like there is nothing without dignity.
Elisa's family has lived in Beit Jala for generations. What's happened to the Kassiya family is just part of daily life for many Palestinians in the occupied West Bank.
And again, put yourself in our place. Walk in our shoes. Imagine living in a village for hundreds of years, then being assaulted by settlers while authorities do nothing. They steal your land and trees. How would you respond? In the West Bank, where I live, an oppressive military occupation controls every aspect of our lives. For almost 60 years, Israel has controlled my country. In all that time, they have refused to show us justice and equality. There are dual systems of law, one for Israelis and another for Palestinians. If my 12-year-old son is accused of a crime and an Israeli adult is accused of the exact same crime in the same location, the Israeli adult will be charged in regular civilian courts, but my son, my 12-year-old boy, will be charged in a military court with military judges. And by the way, do you know that Palestinian children are the only children in the world who face prosecution in military courts? Under martial laws, they are often abducted in the middle of the night, blindfolded, and transferred to adult facilities inside Israel where their access to families and lawyers is denied. They can be held without charges or trial based on secret evidence that is not disclosed to the detainees or their legal representatives. And hundreds of children are abducted in this manner each year. These teenage boys were arrested in their homes at night. They were never told the reason why, nor were they ever charged with a crime. We can't help but wonder, would the world sit in silence if these were European children or children in New York or Texas? According to Israeli military law, a child can spend a year in prison for insulting a soldier's honor, and throwing stones can receive a sentence of 10 to 20 years in prison. And since October 7th, even the Red Cross has been denied access to visit these children. Ask yourself, what would make that necessary? The teachings of Jesus in Matthew 25 reminds us, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you did it to me." Here, Jesus emphasizes that he is present in the hungry, the thirsty, the strangers, the naked, the sick, and imprisoned. Those oppressed and deprived of opportunities. And today, that reality is present in Palestine and is present in Gaza. Today, we ask, how many more must die before the world decides enough is enough? How many more children must be killed before Christians open their eyes? How many churches must be attacked before the Christian community recognizes that this is wrong and it must stop? Moreover, Israel has carried out these actions with the support of American weapons and policies. It is time for a serious conversation. It's time to repent. This is about the credibility of our Christian witness. Your silence was too loud. Micah 6:8 is clear. He has told you, O man, what is good and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. Brothers and sisters, will you be obedient?
What you just heard was Palestinian pastor and author Munzer Ishaq delivering a sermon to the West. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Natalie Stricker, human and social rights activist and campaigner based in the UK, who served as a human rights monitor in Hebron in the occupied West Bank in 2018, spoke about Christmas and what it means at a vigil held for Palestine in the UK on December 20th, 2025. Let's listen to her remarks.
So I really wanted to talk about Christmas and what Christmas means. Christmas is a time we think about peace on earth and a wish of goodwill to all. It's a beautiful wish. Some will pray about it. And despite all I see in the world, I do believe that it is the desire of the majority. However, we need to find it in ourselves to move beyond holding it as a wish, something we pray for, and rather it becomes something we commit ourselves to, working towards, struggle for, something we make an active individual personal contribution towards through every interaction we have, through our consumer choices, in the language we use, the things we share. But as I say this, I'm not suggesting that it is something light and fluffy, where we censor ourselves from saying things that might make some people feel uncomfortable. For peace and goodwill cannot come into being if there is an absence of true justice. And it can and must never exclude any group of people. Because the moment we exclude a group on the basis of their ethnicity, religion, or color, it immediately becomes unachievable. More than that, it endangers all of us. We need to be wise enough to recognize this. The Palestinian people, as I stated recently, are the most dehumanized people on our planet. Even uttering Palestinian or Palestine is considered controversial, despite 8 decades of oppression, dispossession, and now genocide. Their struggle for liberation is considered complicated. Using the Arabic word Palestinians use to describe their struggle, a word that literally means shaking off, but more commonly understood as uprising, no different to the word used to describe the brave Jews in a Warsaw ghetto, is somehow twisted by mainstream media and groups with a very specific agenda into a code word for a different kind of horror. And recognizing their rights as a community enshrined in international law is suggested to be even criminal in our upside down worlds. And this is why, if we believe in the message of Jesus Christ, whether Christian or not, because it does not require faith to believe in an ideal, then we need to reflect on what it truly means, as well as that of his golden rule of do unto others as you'd have them do to you. This requires us to find the courage to confront our own prejudices and understand where they come from, how they were formed, and then to have the same courage to name what is happening and why. And the why must necessarily include being brave enough to recognize how our governments in the West, alongside, yes, Arab governments, are actively complicit. Because as Francesca Albanese has highlighted in her reports, there is a killing to be made in genocide. And this is a heartbreaking reality. We can do better, brothers and sisters. And we must, as I've said so many times before. What we have witnessed unfold in Palestine, the most televised genocide in our history, is a stain on our collective conscience. And it debases all of us. And what we need to truly understand is that whether we like it or not, our futures, our lives are inextricably linked, for good or bad. What we allow to be done to other, we do allow to be done to ourselves. So let us take up our moral obligation and determine to do all we can through using our voices, through boycott, divest and sanction, through lobbying our political representatives, through educating ourselves and others, and also more widely, rejecting every form of racism, bigotry. And yes, that includes not just anti-Palestinian racism, but also real anti-Semitism, which requires us to ensure that we do not accept the conflation of Israel and the Jewish community, and Zionism, a political ideology of over a little 100 years, and Judaism, an ancient and beautiful faith, as this endangers our Jewish brothers and sisters further. I have focused on Palestine, but I also ask you to consider similarly of our brothers and sisters in Sudan, the Congo, who are also being subjected to genocide, as well as to remember all oppressed and brutalized groups around the world. May our gift for Christmas this year, brothers and sisters, and for all future ones, be to embody in our every utterance, choice and action, a true and just peace and goodwill to all. Merry Christmas and free, free! Free, free! Free, free! Thank you.
That was Natalie Stricker, human and social rights activist and campaigner based in the UK, who served as a human rights monitor in Hebron in the occupied West Bank in 2018, speaking about Christmas and what it means at a vigil held for Palestine in the UK on December 20th, 2025. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Some of you may have heard about the 1,000 American pastors, mostly evangelical influencers, who visited apartheid Israel in December 25 to attend a summit. One would think, finally, this could be a big one, for 1,000 pastors from the U.S. to go there and see firsthand the ongoing genocide and catastrophic situation Palestinians, including Christian Palestinians, have been going through under the brutal Israeli military occupation. But no, that was not the case. They went there to basically be trained by apartheid Israel to push for Israeli propaganda. Soumaya Al-Ghannouchi, a British Tunisian writer and expert in Middle East politics, commented on that with an opinion to Middle East Eye on Zionist evangelicals attempting to erase centuries of Palestinian Christianity. Let's take a listen.
About 2 weeks ago, more than 1,000 American evangelical pastors and Christian influencers traveled to Israel in what organizers hailed as a historic pilgrimage, the largest such delegation since the state's founding. Arranged by the Friends of Zion Initiative and blessed by Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the visit was greeted with presidential ceremony. It was marketed as a spiritual awakening. In reality, it was a political crusade cloaked in the language of revelation. From Jerusalem stages came the familiar liturgy. Mike Huckabee urged attendees to return home with the fire of God burning in your bones so that they might be pro-Bible and therefore pro-Israel. Mike Evans, founder of the Friends of Zion Museum and self-styled kingmaker behind Netanyahu, warned against giving Bible land to radical Islam Jew haters. The message was unmistakable. Israel presented as biblical truth made flesh, its enemy reduced to radical Islam, the conflict framed as a cosmic duel between Judeo-Christian virtue and Muslim darkness. This script is not new. It's been rehearsed for decades and faithfully echoed by Christian Zionists who imagine themselves guardians of a besieged holy land. But the entire spectacle rests on a deception that Palestine is a story of Jews versus Muslims, and that Christians, by faith, by identity, by history, naturally belong on Israel's side. Christians are not outsiders in Palestine. They're not visitors, observers, or decorative minorities. They're indigenous, ancient, constitutive of the Palestinian people, older than Zionism, older than Europe's nation states, older than the political theologies now mobilized in Israel's defense. For over 14 centuries, Muslims and Christians in Palestine lived not in grudging coexistence, but within a shared civilization, deep, sustained, and organically lived. That history begins in 637 CE, when Jerusalem surrendered peacefully. Patriarch Sophronius agreed to hand over the city's keys only to Caliph Umar ibn al-Khattab himself. Umar traveled from Medina with one servant and a single camel. They took turns riding it. As they approached Jerusalem, it happened to be the servant's turn to ride while Umar walked beside him. Those waiting mistook the servant for the Caliph. The ruler of a vast empire entered Jerusalem on foot, dressed simply indistinguishable from the people around him, a quiet inversion of power. Alma refused spectacle. He refused domination disguised as holiness. He signed a covenant guaranteeing Christian lives, churches, property, and worship. Not one church was destroyed, not one Christian was forced to convert. When invited to pray inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, Omar declined. He explained that if he prayed there, others might later seize the church in his name. Instead, he prayed outside and forbade Muslims from ever turning the church into a mosque. Power restrained itself deliberately. That ethic endured. When Salah ad-Din al-Ayyubi later liberated Jerusalem, the arrangement governing the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was accepted by Christian custodians as a stabilizing solution. By mutual consent, the keys were entrusted to two Muslim families, the Jude al-Husaynis and the Nusaybis, neutral stewards of a shared sacred space. More than 8 centuries later, they still open the doors each morning and close them each night. This is not domination, it's stewardship. That shared life carried into modern Palestinian history. During the Great Revolt against British rule in the 1930s, Christians were not peripheral, they were leaders. Fuad Serba served as secretary of the Arab High Committee. Alfred Rosh of Yerfa was among its members. The Palestinian flag bore both crescent and cross, symbols of a national movement sustained by both faiths. Later generations produced an extraordinary constellation of Palestinian Christian figures. George Habash, founder of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Naif Hawatmi, leader of the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Hanan al-Ashrawi, the articulate diplomat, Emil Habibi, novelist and political leader who gave literary form to the lived absurdities of Palestinian life under settler colonial rule. Edward Said, one of the most influential intellectuals of the 20th century, who reshaped entire disciplines, literature, cultural studies, post-colonial theory, while remaining firmly rooted in the Palestinian experience. Khalil Sekakini, the Jerusalemite educator and diarist. Nabiha Nasser, founder of Birzeit University, educator, feminist, and Arab nationalist. Palestinian Christianity was never marginal. It was central to politics, to culture, to education, and moral imagination. And in the arts, that unity was lived rather than declared. The Trio Jabran, three Christian brothers from Nazareth who carried the words of Mahmoud Darwish, a Muslim poet, to world stages, because in Palestine, culture was never sectarian, it was shared. A few weeks ago, I attended their concert at the Barbican. Before One Piece, The Trees We Wear, Samir, one of the brothers, explained its origin. It had been written deliberately as a love song. No politics, just an insistence on something Palestinians are rarely allowed, the right to be romantic, tender, fully human. Shireen Abu Aqli once attended their concert in Ramallah and said that that piece was her favorite. 3 years later, Shireen, a Palestinian-American Christian journalist, was shot dead by Israeli soldiers while covering a military incursion in Jenin. Her body fell beneath a tree. The trio later dedicated the song to her. A love song became mourning. When Shireen's coffin was carried through East Jerusalem, Muslims and Christians stood together to shield it as Israeli forces attacked the pallbearers. This is the Christianity Christian Zionists refuse to see, because Palestinian Christianity exposes the lie at the heart of their narrative. This is not a civilizational war. It is a colonial project, one that has devastated Christian life. In 1948, Zionist militias bombed the Semiramis Hotel, killing 25 Palestinian Christians. 12 Christian villagers were executed in Eilabon. The Nakba displaced around 90,000 Christians and closed dozens of churches. During Israel's assault on Gaza, churches were bombed. Even the Church of the Nativity endured military siege. Before 1948, Christians made up more than 12% of Palestine. Today, barely one. Clergy like Dr. Mundhir Ishaq warned that by 2050 there may be no indigenous Christian presence left at all, and still Christian Zionists remain silent. They defend a state that bombs churches while claiming biblical values. They sanctify power while ignoring the people whose faith was born on this land. They also echo a deeper contempt. British commentator Melanie Phillips dismissed Christianity itself as nothing more than a Jewish sect that got slightly out of hand, revealing how easily Christianity is instrumentalized, then discarded. Because this was never about God. What presents itself as Christian solidarity is in truth the willing placement of Christianity in the service of a supremacist exclusionary ideology, one that cannot tolerate Palestine as it is, plural, indigenous, historically layered. You can't defend Christianity while empowering a project that is extinguishing its oldest communities. You can't claim fidelity to Christ while blessing the erasure of the land's first Christians. Christian Zionism doesn't merely ignore this destruction, it enables it. It provides the alibi, the veneer of righteousness, the moral camouflage. What remains is not faith, but ideology, wearing scripture as disguise, not belief, but power, seeking absolution. That is the Christianity made invisible here, and that disappearance, more than any sermon or slogan, exposes the deepest hypocrisy of all, invoking Christ while standing shoulder to shoulder with those destroying the very roots of Christianity itself.
That was Soumaya Al-Ghannouchi, a British-Tunisian writer and expert in Middle East politics, delivering an opinion to Middle East Eye on Zionist evangelicals attempting to erase centuries of Palestinian Christianity. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Mohammed Bakri, an award-winning Palestinian actor and filmmaker, died at the age of 72 on December 24, 2025 in Palestine. Amongst his production is the award-winning film documentary Jenin Jenin about Israel's 2002 assault on the West Bank town of Jenin, and also the film 1948 and the autobiographical documentaries Since You Left and Zahra. He was one of the most influential voices in Palestinian cinema. In March 2014, I met Mohammed Bakri in Texas, where he visited Houston, and he was presented with an award during that visit by the Palestinian American Cultural Center. I interviewed Mohammed Bakri on this program, Arab Voices, when he was in Houston in 2014, and in memory, I'm going to re-air most of the interview I conducted with him. Let's listen in. Award-winning, world-renowned, and one of the leading Palestinian actors and film directors, Mohammed Bakri was born in a small village in the Galilee. He went to elementary school in his hometown and received his secondary education in the nearby city of Akka. He studied acting and Arabic literature at Tel Aviv University and graduated from there. He has acted in numerous international films and in various countries, including France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Denmark, and Canada. Amongst his production is the award-winning film documentary Jenin Jenin, which was about Israel's 2002 assault on the West Bank town of Jenin. He also directed the film 1948 and the autobiographical documentaries Since You Left and Zahra. Over the years, Mohammed Bakri received numerous awards and recognitions, with the last one received right here in Houston this past Saturday when he was honored by the Palestinian American Cultural Center at their gala. Mohammed, welcome to Arab Voices.
Ahlan fiik,
and welcome also to Houston.
Oh, thank you very much.
We're very pleased to have you on the show. We want to talk to you about so many things, your acting, the film production, and all the good work that you do. But if I may start by asking you about, you're a Palestinian, you live in Israel, you have Israeli citizenship, many people know there by the 1948 area, Arab Israel, they call them that, of course, you're a Palestinian. You were born there and you've lived there, you still live there all of your life. How is it like to live as a Palestinian under Israeli full control? How much freedom you have versus the Palestinians who live in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank? How different is that?
Well, it's a big difference, because comparing to our brothers in the West Bank and in Gaza, we are more free to move, because they're still under the militaristic rule, they're still occupied. We, in a quotation mark, we were born automatically. Everybody who was born after 1948, automatically he is a citizen. He is not a real citizen like a Polish Jew or Russian Jew or American Jew or whatever, but he is a citizen in quotation mark. I say in quotation mark because we are discriminated. We don't have the rights that every Israeli Jewish have, because, as you know, especially recently, every government is saying and insisting that this is the place of the Jews. It must be called like the Jew country, Dawla al-Yahudiya, the Jew state. So if you ask yourself the very simple question, if you are not Jew, what are you are in this in this country? What are you in this country? I am not Jew. Fortunately or unfortunately, I was born Palestinian for Palestinian parents, so I'm not Jew, so I'm out of this, Ma'adali. How do you say Ma'adali?
Equation or formula.
So if you are not, you are not a part of, so it's like to be a stranger in your home. You ask me about how to feel. I feel like a stranger in my home. I mean, I feel very close to my village, very close to my family, very close to my people. But I don't feel close to this culture. I don't feel close to this country officially. I feel outsider. I mean, when they have football game, I don't identify with them. When they have, for example, something to celebrate, national things to celebrate, I don't feel a part of it. I feel outsider. And I feel that I'm not, I mean, مش مرغوب فيه يعني. A ghost.
Like you're not wanted there.
I'm not wanted in the positive. I'm not wanted. I am wanted, but I'm not wanted. I'm wanted in the cowboy meaning, but I'm not wanted in the civil meaning.
To be a free citizen, to do just like the others.
That's right. For example, I give you a very simple example. I made a film called Jenin about the Palestinian community inside the camp Jenin during the Israeli very cruel and massive invasion during 2002. Mm-hmm. I was taken to the court. I was hunted. I was, until now, since 2002 until now, I'm paying the price. If I was Jew, Israeli Jew, I doubt if I have facing the same thing that I'm facing as a Palestinian Mohammed Bakri, who is not Jew. So the democracy in Israel and the freedom in Israel, if you say, I said that we are more free than our brother in the West Bank and Gaza, it's not true. Because democracy must be for everybody and not for some communities and not other communities.
Now, so Israel's population is about 6 million, but out of more than 6
about
million.
Eight, nine million, yes.
Who live in Israel.
Yes.
And the Palestinians.
And in the West Bank.
No, I'm talking about Israel itself.
Settlers, I mean.
Yeah, if you want to count them. The Palestinian population, those who carry Israeli citizenship, and basically, and as you mentioned earlier, those who were born after 1948, they were given Israeli citizenship. And those are not the ones who are live in the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, or
Jerusalem. Yeah, you mean inside Israel of the 67, before 67 war.
Correct. Those are about 20% of the Israeli population, correct?
20, yes.
20%. So, and so that translates into about 2 million Palestinians or so.
Less. It's like less. 1,600,000, yes.
So those Palestinians who carry the Israeli citizenship, but they are not really treated fairly, they are not treated, they are discriminated against, basically.
Yes.
Tell us more about those measures that Israel does that discriminates. In what ways do they discriminate against those Palestinians? I know in the education system, for example, one time I've had several guests who talk.
I give you a very simple example. Mm-hmm. We have one theater inside Israel, mm-hmm. which is the Arab theater for the Palestinians inside Israel. This theater is for 1,600,000 people, okay? The budget for this theater is maybe less than 1 million shekel. Less than 1 million shekel. Comparing to Israel theater, Habima theater, or Hakamish theater, they have 80 million shekel. So it's not even 1%. I mean, if you compare the same thing about schools, the same thing about municipalities, the budget which given to the Palestinian community is أقل من 1%. Less than 1%, comparing to the Israeli side. So, and it's going everywhere with you. Everywhere you go, you find this discrimination in every Israeli office, in every institute. So you can feel it everywhere. Another thing, all the villages cannot develop itself, you know. You cannot build, you cannot build your house without license, and they don't give you license, so you must give without built without license. And there is it's very cramped, you know.
And when you build without a license, then after a while they
destroy your
house. And they demolish it, just like they do with the Palestinians in the occupied territories.
More or less. Yes. More or less. Yeah. So you are not really a citizen. It's siyaset tatfish. You know what's the meaning of siyaset tatfish?
Part of their ethnic cleansing.
It's a kind of, if not good for you, go away.
Yeah.
You know, the young people, all the young people have the American dream, you know. All the young people, not the average American dream, not as everybody in the world, every young in the world. The young are dreaming to escape from this place because they feel like they are in a ghetto, like in a prison. And I don't think there is a difference between my village to any Palestinian camp in the West Bank or in Lebanon or in Syria. The same thing. What's the meaning of a camp? A camp, it's like small ghetto. I'm sorry to use this word because it's giving another connotation, but it's true. I mean, you are not free to develop yourself. You are not free to develop your work, your talent. So that's the way.
Now, you mentioned earlier, and as we all know, Israel is trying to get quote-unquote recognitions by everybody out there, especially the Palestinians, that it's a Jewish state only. It's a Jewish state. They want to call it that Jewish state.
They want to call it.
Do you see that as part of their systematic plan to at one point say this is only for Jews and you are not wanted here, period, or part of a swap, whether it's for lands, population, and so on, targeting the 1,600,000 Palestinians who carry Israeli citizenships to basically evict them, to basically ethnically cleanse them from where they are now?
Yeah, the funny thing is the name. Jew and democratic. Israel is a Jewish democratic state. How it can be democratic and Jew in the same time? Or it must be democratic or it must be Jewish. Because if it's Jewish, it's for the Jews. So we are out of the map. If it's democratic, it's for everybody and we are not everybody. So something wrong with this, you know, with this tarif. So it cannot be democratic if it's Jew. It can be democratic only in one case, if it's democratic for all citizens in Israel. And this is not happening yet until now.
I want to talk more about Jenin. Jenin, you mentioned the film and how you were discriminated against and you were taken to trial. And you were taken to trial, and it's still affecting you and your life. The documentary film that you produced, that you did, Jenin Jenin, that has won several international awards and recognitions. And you mentioned it briefly. It was about Israel's assault in 2002 on the Palestinian camp, Jenin, in the occupied West Bank, where I believe it was 53 Palestinians who were killed, dozens injured, hundreds of buildings destroyed, completely demolished. It was nothing less than a war crime described by many out there.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more about that. What prompted you to go there and to document what has happened? And what message were they trying to do?
I am an actor. I don't consider myself a director. But sometimes in life, I found myself pushed to direct. Because when you see wrong things happening, when you see, for example, when you see a global punishment for the whole community because something wrong happened in one place. For example, when there is some operation, Palestinian operation, young people who try to make some militaristic operation somewhere, the policy in Israel that the army by the order of the government, of Minister of Defense, make operation which punish the whole community. And that's what happened in Jenin, the camp, and that's what happened now in Gaza, for example. All the citizens in Gaza, about more than a million, you know that, more than a million people in Gaza.
Nearly 2 million now.
Nearly 2 million. They are under siege more than 10 years. They are in a very big prison more than 10 years. And the people who are paying the price, it's not Hamas. It's not the leadership of Hamas. It's the citizens, the people, the simple, poor people. The same thing happening in the West Bank, and the same happened in the camps, in the Palestinian camps, all over the country in the West Bank.
And in many cases also, Israel doesn't really need the justification to do its war crimes to attack the Palestinians.
Yeah, I mean, just 3-4 days ago, exactly. three young people were killed in the camp Jenin, and yes. Mr. Bibi Netanyahu was very proud and declared that it's a great operation because we must hurt the people who won't hurt us. If you want to hurt the people who want to hurt you, why you hurt the whole community? I don't understand. If Muhammad or Richard do something wrong, punish Richard and Muhammad. Why you have to punish Muhammad's father and mother and brothers and neighborhood? The same with Richard. I mean, something wrong here. So I faced this case many, many times in my life. It's not, Palestinians are not my neighbors. Palestinians are my brothers. I have family in Lebanon, and I have family in Syria, and I have family in Gaza, and I have family in Egypt. So when you punish these people, you punish me, because you punish people who are my relatives, and I have a relation with them. You know, I have an uncle who escaped. He was pushed to escape in 1948 to Lebanon, and his name is Hamad. After 67, around 70s, he came to visit by license, by yes, please. He came to visit the village, and I met him the first time in my life. But my mother knew him very well. He is her uncle. So this man, after the war in 1982, after the Israeli invasion in Lebanon, he escaped to Australia. And one day, he called me, he called my mother, and I hold the telephone, and I said, hello. He said, hello. I said, hi, my uncle, Hamad, kif halak, how are you? And then there was a silence on the other line, and I heard something like something happening, and then I said, what happened? He said, nothing. I said, you are crying. He said, yes. I said, why you are crying? He said, because nobody in Melbourne in Australia called me Ami Khali. Nobody called me uncle. And he died in Melbourne. So I'm not talking about people from the moon. I'm not talking about people who are from far neighborhood. I'm talking about my body, my soul, my blood. So when these things happen in the West Bank, and it's happening oftenly, I felt that I must do something, and that's what happened to me when I did Jenin.
Now, it was Israeli soldiers, as I understand it, that actually took you to court, not that's the right. Israeli government, because of that movie, right?
Yes, 5 Israeli soldiers took me to court for Jenin. And one Israeli soldier was the trigger that made me going and sneaking, tzellal, to the camp and making this film. He was shooting at us just during a demonstration near Jenin, the camp. We were demonstrating against the war on the checkpoint, Jalami checkpoint, north to Jenin. And he crossed by his white, ugly Subaru, and he stopped his car and he started shooting at us. And I was shocked. Not me, not only me. Hundreds of people were Jews and Arabs together demonstrating against the war. And he started shooting at us, just to kill. And then I asked myself, if this soldier shooting at us just because we are demonstrating, how he behaved inside the camp? You can imagine. And this was the trigger that pushed me to sneak and to go and to shoot this film. This was a very specific, concrete example why I did Jinin Jinin.
And that trial, I think, it went on for several years, up to 2011.
10 years, 10 years.
10 years, and then it was dismissed in court, right?
Yes, I won.
You won.
Yes.
Yes. Now, you have a very strong message, and I've watched it more than once several years ago when it came out. It's very strong. It's very powerful, really, the images that you show, the interviews that you have done, the message that came from that Jinin Jinin speaks loud of the Israeli war crimes and atrocities that took place there. And they repeated it in Gaza, and it's just ongoing for so, so many years against the Palestinians and so on. And you know, you did another documentary called 1948.
Yes.
Which was basically elderly people talking about that experience and Nakba, the catastrophe.
Yes, it's about 50 years of Palestinian Nakba.
Yes.
The Israeli TV was celebrating 50 years of Israeli establishment. So I was looking and saying, what about the 50 years of the Palestinian Nakba? Who did that? Nobody mentioned that. So. Yeah. I decided to do it, because if I was not doing that, I have the doubt that nobody was doing that. So I did it just for my own personal history, to put it in my house and for my people to see, to watch what's going on. The same thing was, you know, my documentary films are reactions and not action.
Yeah.
Every time when I did a film, when I decided to make a documentary, it was a reaction and not action.
We are speaking with Mohammed Bakri, an extraordinary actor and filmmaker and producer, a Palestinian who has won numerous awards for his work.
And very bad English speaker.
You're speaking very fine, believe me. So we are glad to have him with us in the studio. You have also, I know you've done so many things as an actor in international films and so on, but those documentaries that are capturing the attention of so many out there, like what we just talked about and so on, and you did Zahra, and there was one more also.
Since You Left.
Since You Left, those. And you have done one that was just released. It's called Yarmouk.
Yes.
It's 8 minutes, but what caught my attention, to be honest with you, are the it has already caused a controversy out there.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are speaking about it.
Yes.
Palestinians and other Arabs and so on. That tell us about it from your own words. What was your goal of that? It's 8 minutes only. It's available, I think, already on YouTube and so on. It's 8 minutes documentary. I'm not sure if it's not really more of a documentary. It's like a film, really.
It's not a documentary.
Yeah, but you're trying to get a message. What is that message from that 8 minute production?
The message was very clear. It was written on the screen after the film finished. I dedicated the film to the Arab nation. Red on black. I mean, I wrote it with red like this on black in order to be clear what I'm telling. And the film is black and white. So it's very clear, the red on the black. It was dedicated to the Arab nation because the Arab nation didn't move a finger, يعني ما حركتش أصبع, since 1948. And it's increasing all the time. The Arabs become more and more lazy and more dead with no soul. Especially for the last 15 years, since the first Gulf War until what's going now in Syria. In Syria is the climax. So I heard a story about a man, a father, who has 6, 7 children, who is selling his daughter in order to save his other children from starving. This is the story that was behind the story of the film. So I did it. And I made the wrong thing, that I mentioned Syria. I think I made a mistake by that, because this starving on this very hard and humiliating situation which bring a father to sell his daughter, it happened, I'm sorry to tell you, in Morocco, and in Egypt, and in Yemen, and in Libya, and in perhaps somewhere also in the camps.
But you called it, the name of it is...
The name was Yarmouk. Yarmouk, when I said Yarmouk without al-ta'rif,
yes.
Al-Yarmouk, I meant through you, يعني بزيتوك, to throw you to the dogs.
So you're not
Yarmouk.
Intending for it, Al-Yarmouk,
no.
The Yarmouk refugee, Palestinian refugee camps in Syria.
I didn't mean that. I didn't
because
mean
that's
Al-Yarmouk.
Most of the controversy was about that. How
that's
could you
right,
even call it Yarmouk when it's actually Al-Yarmouk? Because there is a big difference.
When the film, yes, that's right. When the film was rough cut, I sent it to some colleague of mine all over the world by internet, by, you know, just email. I give them a link and they, in order to see the film and to give me their advice. Because I believe in advice. I believe in sharing idea. يعني أنا بأمن بالشورة.
Yeah.
Anyway. So, some of my friends give it to the Facebook. Put it on Facebook. So the people in Yarmouk saw the film and they thought I mean them. So they were hurt. How come you say that a Palestinian father with his dignity can do such like that thing that he sell his daughter? I didn't mean that. So many people were very, very hurt by that. I'm sorry. I didn't mean that. And I told them, it is a rough cut. It's not completed. I didn't finish the film yet. The film is black and white, and I need to make my last touches on the film. And I hope now it's more calm because I'm really finishing the film.
So you still have a whole lot more to do with it.
Yes.
So people will
starting see from the name and finishing by some other points.
Yeah.
According to the body of the film.
Muhammad, unfortunately, we are out of time, but I do want to get your view in a few seconds, if even possible. Do you support a one-state solution, as some people are calling for, to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian problem? Do you subscribe to that school of thought that it should be one state for all, or two states? In a few seconds, if you will.
This is my dream, to have one state for everybody, but the Israelis don't want that.
What you just heard was an interview I conducted with Mohammed Bakri, an award-winning Palestinian actor and filmmaker who died at the age of 72 on December 24, 2025, in Palestine. I conducted that interview with Mohammed in March 2014, 12 years ago on this program, Arab Voices. May he rest in peace. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.